On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 19-term New York Congressman Charles Rangel grew up hard in Harlem, dropped out of high school, and shipped out to fight in the Korean War before he was 20. When you hear Charles Rangel call for a draft for the Iraq War today, you need to understand that history. And now that Rangel is Democratic chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, there's more you may need to know about his life as well. Up next on Point, a conversation with Charles Rangel on a life in politics and the meaning of the Democrats' takeover on Capitol Hill. Joining me from New York City is Charles Rangel, Democratic representative from New York's 15th district since 1971, when he succeeded Adam Clayton Powell. In that same year, he co-founded the Congressional Black Caucus. With the Democrats' victory in November, he became chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's just out with a new memoir called And I Haven't Had a Bad Day Since, From the Streets of Harlem to the Halls of Congress. Haven't had a bad day since. Charles Rangel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. NPR is my favorite.
Well, and you're right out there on all kinds of fronts all the time, and especially since November. We're going to learn a lot more about your life than we may have known today, Charlie Rangel. But let me just ask you first to kind of set the stage here. There was a lot of talk about bipartisanship as the Democrats moved back into power. How's that holding up?
Well, I don't know about the House and the Senate as a whole, but I could never expect better than my relationship with the senior Republican, Jim McCrary, that's on the committee. I've worked very closely with Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, and most of our legislative jurisdiction falls within his domain. And I talked with Jim and indicated that, you know, Democrats are in the majority a lot because of the war, but I think a lot had to do with the partisanship and the fighting, the food fighting that took place, and that I didn't think that I wanted to spend the rest of my life a continuation of that, and that Republicans were in the minority. They didn't have any coattails, certainly, with the President Bush, and that he and I together could work together and do some great things and not even fear a veto. He agreed, and we've been moving in that direction.
Let me ask you, you're reading in your memoir here, you were clearly kind of a deal maker in your bones, with your principles, clearly, but a guy who wants to make a deal, and at this point, as well, with all these years in Congress, a deal maker and an old-timer. What about the Young Turks, the new generation of Democrats who helped you take back the majority in November? Are they with you in that attitude? Let's work with the Republicans. Or are they saying, no, let's make a sharp turn here. Let's get out of this groove we've been in.
No. Well, with the Republicans generally, they are concerned about the war. And I think that they are far more pleasant than they've been in the past. I don't like to name names, but Tom DeLay, who was the majority leader, wasn't out for compromise or bipartisanship. He and the former chairman of Ways and Means, they wanted to have Republican policy. As a matter of fact, Tom DeLay would say that he wanted a permanent Republican Congress. And so what it meant was that you had to go to moderates who didn't believe that and threaten to run candidates against them or deny them opportunities for legislative input. And so, especially on my committee, in order for the chairman to control the Republicans, they didn't have much opportunity to participate. In order for me and Democrats to succeed, we need Republicans to work with us because of the diversity of our party. And so even though the Republicans wish they had won, they welcome the opportunity to have hearings, to be able to select their witnesses, to have amendments, and try to get back to what the founders of the country wanted with the United States Congress.
We'll see how that plays out. So many issues on your plate as chairman of House Ways and Means, and I was fascinated how your life informs those. Haven't had a bad day since, referring back to just how bad it was in the Korean War. Compared to that, everything looks pretty good to Charlie Rangel, what we're reading here. You've taken strong positions on the war and in particular on the draft, on bringing back a draft to take troops to Iraq. It struck me that we really can't understand your view on that without understanding where you came from, Charlie Rangel. I wish you'd take us back to the young Charlie Rangel, what, 18, 19, when you shipped out for Korea, and the scene there that turned out to be a turning point in your life, in your understanding of war and life from then on out. Paint the picture. Take us back. How did you end up in Korea? And take us to that cold moment when you barely escaped and maybe came out a new man.
Well, things were pretty rough for my family as a kid. And I remembered that my brother, when he was in World War II, would send these what they call allotment checks to my mom, and they were so well needed. Mm. And I had nickel and dime jobs, but nothing meaningful. I dropped out of high school. And I had the opportunity to join the Army. It was peacetime. The war to end all wars was over.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I went from Fort Dix to Fort Lewis, Washington. And in June of 1950, I was 20 years old, and the sergeant came in and said, "Okay, men, we're shipping up. We're going to Korea, and we got to stop the North Korean communists from taking over South Korea, the democracy." I had no idea where the hell Korea was. And we were loaded up on ships and took 13 days to get there. Then they said that the North Koreans had won and that we couldn't land, but ultimately MacArthur cut them off in the back, and we found ourselves fighting our way from the tips of South Korea past the 38th parallel, which separated the country. And we pretty well cleaned up everything with North Koreans. What we did not know is that tens of thousands of Chinese, and we were on their border,
right,
had surrounded us. And for 3 days had communicated to us at night that they were going to massacre us, that the blacks should really quit and surrender. They had captured some of our forward observers who were testifying on these loudspeakers for us to surrender, that we shouldn't be involved in that.
So
that,
you heard American voices from the Chinese side saying, "Brother, get out of there, go home.
Go home," and, you know, they won't even, it's 20 below, you got to freeze to death, you got to get killed. Mm. In the South, they won't even let you go to the resorts there because of racism. What are you doing here? It's a family dispute.
And they were specifically speaking to black Americans among the troops there? Was that a significant portion of the troops in that, well, I guess, Kunuri is where you were?
No. The entire 8th Army, they had a different message for everybody. This propaganda was really working true to us. We were a black outfit in a white division.
Yeah.
But they had different messages to send, and they would say that, "Why are you being killed? How would you be missed?" And this built up for 3 days. We lost so many people that just froze to death because they had us captured as hostage, saying that if we didn't just get up and walk away. Mm-hmm. In any event, when they hit, they really hit. We were able to see white officers helicoptering out of the area before they hit. And I was on, when they came, tens of thousands on horses with bugles, the screaming, the killing, the machine gunning, the grenades, the mortars, and around me was just carnage. You could see trucks being blown up. I saw some of my comrades being carried away with their hands over their heads, the screaming, the moaning, and I found myself bleeding in a ditch. And it was a nightmare, and I knew I was going to die. I thought I'd just lie there and act as though I was dead, and I could hear my heart beating so loud. I said, you know, if I'm going to die, let me see who's going to kill me, but...
And you heard somebody say to you, Sergeant, Sergeant's going to get us out of here. Someone, you.
No, maybe. That was later. What happened was that I told Jesus, if you're listening and you get me out of this mess, you'd have no problems with Charlie Rangel for the rest of my life. And somehow I jokingly say that Jesus says, if you want to get a good start, you better get out of that damn hole.
Stand up, man.
But I, with all that was going on around me, I didn't know where to go. And I saw a guy who later turned out to be Sergeant Rivers. He was captured screaming and running up a side of this mountain. And I said, hell, he looks like he's going to make it. And I ran up after him, and... on this mountain, they had big mounds where the Koreans bury people, and instead of tombstones, they have these mounds. And I was surprised to see so many of the kids in my outfit hiding behind this. And when they saw Sergeant Rangel moving forward, they thought I knew what the hell I was doing, and they followed me. And for 3 days, we stayed together. I had maps and compasses, but hell, I didn't know what I was doing. We crossed the same stream 3 times.
You made it out of there.
I made it out, and so many more friends of mine didn't make it out. As a matter of fact, President Clinton honored me in allowing me to take what was left of my outfit back to a Korea. And in 2000, which was the 50th anniversary of our entry into that war, and so many of them had been prisoners, and they were crossing a bridge between North Korea and South Korea, and they saw it, and they just fell on their knees, and everyone around them, it was such an emotional experience because none of them ever thought that they would come out of that alive. And so everything in life, I've tried to compare either consciously or unconsciously, and the fact I was alive, so many people were not alive, they were not captured. I mean, I was not captured. I got out and got back home and managed to get back to high school and finish up. And each one was challenges, not getting a job, not being appreciated as a veteran, not having an education, being turned down by the VA, getting into school, working 2 or 3 jobs, but knowing that life was always getting better for me because I wasn't having a bad day.
You come out of it with an amazingly sunny attitude. It informs so much of what you do, even when you're down in the rough and dirty on Capitol Hill. We're going to look at more of that history in Harlem, how it informs the way you see the world. But draw the line straightforward for us first, if you would, from that experience in the Korean War and your call fairly early on for us to reinstate a draft to get troops over to Iraq. Is there a connection? Describe it, the line from Korea to your call for a draft.
Well, first of all, it wasn't clear how in the heck I got in Korea when the United States Congress never declared war. And I kind of felt that a part of my political life was to make certain that nothing like that ever happened again.
Do you regret the Korean War? South Korea has been a pretty great success story. A line was drawn there that stood for a long time against a pretty bad regime in the North.
I thought it was a great thing to do. I thought it was great getting rid of Saddam Hussein. I think it's great to get rid of the dictators all over the world. But what the heck has that got to do with me and Lenox Avenue joining the army? I love my country, and I don't have any problem defending her against anybody that would want to destroy what we've had. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was able to get the President of the United States and the Congress to honor the Tuskegee Airmen.
Yes, we saw that.
These people were called subhuman. They were cowards. They couldn't fly planes. And they turned out to be the greatest patriots in the world, knowing the racism that existed in this country. But they loved this country and knew that we as a people can do better here and prosper here and gain equality here more than any country in the world. But what are we talking about when we're trying to resolve cultural, religious problems between people in the Middle East? What are we talking about when they say that some of bin Laden is responsible for 9/11, and then we go after Saddam Hussein.
Okay, but we're in the middle of it, and you say, fine then, let's have a draft to do it. Why a draft, Congressman?
Well, a draft would say that those people who make the decision is those people who support war, those people who say, you go ahead and fight, I'll hold your coat. They should realize that other people, children, are dying in this. And if you don't think it's worthwhile to draft people and have everyone to make some sacrifice, then you should not believe in the war. I think it is hypocritical for people to tell me that America must stand up wherever they have an opportunity to show our military superiority, but refuse to consider having their children, their loved ones, to get involved in making this sacrifice. So there's no question in my mind. It's when the Congress made a decision to authorize the president to invade Iraq that if they thought their children or their constituents' children would be involved, then we never would have gone. The fact that 90% of the recruits' offices are in areas of the highest unemployment, that these kids are encouraged to join not only because of educational benefits, but they offer $10, $20, $30, and now $40,000, it's an indication of the incentives that they're giving.
Chairman Rangel, Charlie Rangel, came out of Korea with a Purple Heart, ultimately a Bronze Star. Now he says, let's have a draft for Iraq. Charles Rangel, a lot of people want to join the conversation with you. Let me begin to turn. We're going to hear more history, but let me go to William in Davenport, Iowa. William, you're on the air with Charles Rangel.
Hello, Tom. I want to compliment, I'm a lifelong Republican, and I want to compliment the congressman on this stand on the draft. Maybe we should have a universal national service where people have an opportunity. Can have a choice as to whether they're going into the military or not. And we should be Democrats. I wish we could come up with some alternative to the military things going on in Iraq.
But why are you for a draft, William? What do you think it would do? What's the point?
Well, the point is that we need the extra troops, and we just can't the Army can't stand this. This strain that's being put on them, it's entirely unfair.
But you saw what happened in Vietnam. We had a draft, and we had masses of people in the streets.
Well, that's I know that, but I was a war veteran from World War II, and we got by with the draft very well. If you had universal military service, people would have a universal national service. People could have a choice as to whether they're going into the military or not. But we need to get these kids off the street that don't seem to know what's going on and make the sacrifices that are necessary to control this world terrorism.
William, we hear it. There's a thumbs up from a Republican in Iowa. Let me go to Dana in San Francisco.
Could I say something?
Sure, Charlie Rangel.
Thank you, because William and I are not that far apart. Mm-hmm. I do believe in mandatory service. Only a fraction of those that would be eligible for the draft would be needed in the actual military. Mm. But William is right. Our young people need an opportunity to know what it's like not only to love this country and respect this country for the opportunities, but also to serve this country. I don't care how people got into the military, where they were screaming and yelling. When they say they are veteran, they are proud of what they have done. And as far as what you're talking about in Vietnam, mine is no exemptions. What caused so many problems is affluent people were able to send their kids to college and avoid. They said this was the biggest boom to education was the draft. But they are no exemption. Men, women, everyone has to go. Everyone has to serve. And it doesn't necessarily mean in the military.
Everybody sign up or be signed up, and you will serve one way or another. Dana is calling from Sandwich, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on the air with Congressman Rangel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Congressman. I really do admire you, but I really don't understand, your position on the draft, because all this talk about sacrifice for one's country and duty, what is it doing? It is serving the Bush administration, which has based the war built on a system of lies. So who is sacrificing to what end? We're not sacrificing for national security here. We're sacrificing for the welfare of Halliburton and Bechtel and other big corporations that want control of Iraqis' resources. I wish somebody would bring that out. This war is not about national security.
Charlie Rangel, how about it? You say everybody serve, but you do also, we heard you say, you're not sure why we're fighting this war, and Dana's responding to exactly that.
Dana's 100% right. What I am saying is that right now, this war's being fought by attracting young people who need the money, who need the educational benefits, and that's what's going on. But under what's going on now, where we find ourselves involved in a religious war, where we find the reasons why we went there never really existed. If you had a broad-based America and not kids just from areas of high employment, we would have never gone in Iraq in the first place.
Are you saying this is a roundabout way to close it down now then, start a draft and the war will end? Is that the Rangel view?
There's no, first of all, no one's going to vote for the draft. But constantly, as we see how we overused our reserve, our National Guard, how we sending these people three and four times, even the Pentagon is saying that we have to consider the draft. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs supports the draft. People who served in World War II know that what we're doing to these volunteers is so totally unfair to them and their families and communities. And so the draft, to me, says if you support the war, and now more and more Americans don't, then you support the draft. If you really don't believe we should be involved in these type of military interventions, then there's no need for the draft.
Let's bring this right up to date. You've been on the record criticizing Vice President Cheney some time ago as a kind of a draft dodger who fights wars with other people's children, like a chess player. You said he likes to move other people's pieces. Cheney's been very critical of the Democrats in Congress in the last few days for their position on war funding. And President Bush today, this morning, has been talking with reporters. Listen with us, Charles Rangel, to what the president's saying today.
It has now been 57 days since I requested that Congress pass emergency funds for our troops. Instead of passing clean bills that fund our troops on the front lines, the House and Senate have spent this time debating bills that undercut the troops. By substituting the judgment of politicians in Washington for the judgment of our commanders on the ground, setting an arbitrary deadline for withdrawal from Iraq, and spending billions of dollars on pork barrel projects completely unrelated to the war. I made it clear for weeks that if either the House or Senate version of this bill comes to my desk, I will veto it.
Charles Rangel, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democrat, what do you say to the president? He says he wants a clean bill and that you, the House Democrats, are undercutting the troops.
First, let me say this. The vice president deliberately applied for five deferments from the draft, and so therefore his patriotism should not be challenged, but again, he finds it very easy to ask for more troops. As it relates to the president, I don't think anyone can challenge that the Democrats had a victory, although not landslide, in part because of the president's involvement in this war and certainly in the way he's handling this situation. So we, at least the overwhelming majority of us, believe that we have to respond to that mandate to make it abundantly clear to the president that his lack of judgment, as the American people see it, is going to be expressed to him in any way that we can. And so he sends us a bill, and he asks for 20,000 or 25,000 more people to go into some type of a surge. When he says, and everyone says, that it cannot be a military victory, why in the world would we ask for more military if we can't have a military victory? And what is our role there was abundantly clear. If you can't win the war, we're involved in a civil war, dealing with religious disputes that America doesn't understand, and the people there don't want us there. And so we send a message there. We say that there should be date certain. And because we didn't have the votes, because some people believe that we shouldn't do it, others people thought that it should be immediate, in order to send a message, we needed a veto. We know now, as we knew then, that the president was going to veto it. And we will continuously send a message to him and to members of Congress, feel the pressure from the people back home to get our troops out of there by any means possible. We heard that the Senate even are prepared, when this is vetoed, to have Republicans join with us, more than the two that did, so that the message will swell to a point that the president will have to change the course. Mm. And so just saying that it's the judgment of the military, it's his judgment. And the president's judgment in this war has not been credible.
There, from a Korean War vet, Chairman Rangel, lots of people want to speak with you. Let's go to Savannah, Georgia. Charles, you're on the air with Charlie Rangel.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Oh, Congressman Rangel, I completely, totally agree with Congressman Rangel's call for a universal draft with no exemptions or anything like that. I think it's an excellent idea. The only thing is, I think I differ with Congressman Rangel very much on why. I originally opposed the Iraq War very strenuously. I think it was a huge mistake. Mm. I still think it was a huge mistake. But given where President Bush has got us now, I think the only way out of Iraq without leaving a hotbed of terrorism and anti-American hatred is to beef up the military, to add another 200,000 troops to our troop level in Iraq and just go in and win the war.
To go way big is the word from Savannah. Charles Rangel, Congressman?
I challenge, thank you for your support on the other area, but win what? Win what? What is a victory here? If you're talking about peace and tranquility and a move towards some type of democracy, what's the role of our so-called friends in the area? I mean, why should Americans be fighting and dying for these admirable goals when we're given billions of dollars every year to Egypt just to keep them off of Israel's back? We have the sheikhs from Saudi Arabia going in and out of the Crawford Ranch. I've never been there, but obviously there's a relationship with them and the president of the United States. The Jordanians and all of these people that understand this culture far better than we do. What the heck is it that we could win? If we could mandate today that there be peace there, my question is it worth another life of an American? I think not.
Dean's calling from Holyoke, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on the air with Congressman Charles Rangel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to express my great respect for Congressman Rangel. And it seems to me like his idea of instituting a draft seems to really strike at the heart of the matter, that there's not a shared sense of sacrifice with this war with an all-volunteer army. I wonder what he thought about the possibility of imposing a gasoline tax to pay for this war and any future wars. That way, not only would we call on people to support the war through their service, but also economically, so we're not burdening our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, good. Dean, you're pulling back the curtain a little further for us here. Charles Rangel, how about it? A gas tax for the war, and broader than that, Democrats have a pay-as-you-go policy in Congress. Now, how are we going to pay for so much of what we're spending in this country after the deficits we've seen recently? But start with Dean's suggestion, a gas tax for the war.
Well, you know, we Democrats don't like to come out talking about taxes, but there is no question that we have to raise revenue. One of the major ways we can do this, of course, is to go after the people, $350 billion who don't pay taxes and avoid taxes. But I don't know. It is true that the cost of the war, which is about $450 billion, is not even included in the budget. There would be trillions of dollars in expenses in terms of trying to rehabilitate this area. I'm not certain whether gasoline is the way to go. It is true that it will have some effect on reducing the use of gasoline, but I'm not prepared now to talk about how we're going to finance this war. I rather concentrate on ending the war and talking about if we have to tax to rebuild our country with education, a sound health system, a rehabilitation of our infrastructure and rebuilding America, and maybe making an appeal to industrialized countries all over to help us to try to put this country back into shape if we can ever stop the peace. But if you think I'm reluctant to talk about taxes, you're right.
You write in the memoir about a youth and more as a poker player in Harlem. We can hear a little cagey poker playing right there. I mean, you said straight up, we can't pay for everything we're doing the way things are now. You don't want to talk about taxes. But you've also said that after 18 years of Ronald Reagan and two Bush administrations, so much of what the New Deal and the GI Bill and the Great Society built in this country has been, you describe it now as in ruins. You've said in your memoir, you say that you are part of what Howard Dean called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And yet we've been around the block a lot of times here. Where do you see the party leading? Are you going to try and rebuild all that was, all that you say is now in ruin? Or is there a new vision that you're putting your poker playing skills to work on, Charles Rangel?
I think there's a new vision. I've taken the position that poverty is a threat to our national security. Lack of education and poor folks not only cost America in terms of the criminal justice system, having illnesses that are so costly, the cost of hospital care, the cost of violence, drugs, abuse, not being able to be competitive or to make a contribution. I think now that our multinational corporations that have been so successful in international trade recognize that our kids are not getting the education and not being able to get the technology in order to make us competitive. I think the Democratic Party has to be talking about not just spending money, but how to invest to make our country stronger. And I think that the private sector understands that, at least as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, I will be trying to teach them.
So you're going to try and turn that around. You write in your memoir that it's a hard time to be hopeful. Are you hopeful?
No. Listen, I've gotten a lot of new friends since I've been chairman of the committee. And I've had some of the largest corporations in America come and ask, how can we help? And I said, the best way that you can help to have people to understand why you want to be competitive abroad is to spend some time here, as you do in developing countries, in developing communities that are going down the economic tube.
But they may be looking at a different part of the agenda than you are. The Wall Street Journal recently has a big editorial saying it's Rangel's hour. Charles Rangel, you know, a guy that business has been able to work with. Now Democrats in pending trade deals looking for tougher labor standards and increased assistance for workers who lose jobs, health care, pension initiatives, you know, a new kind of trade policy. Which way are you going to swing on that?
What are you talking about? That's what I just got finished saying, and that is that these corporations realize that as long as America looks at trade as something that's detrimental to their lives, as long as they look at communities where families and have been destroyed, plants are gone, kids are trying to get out of town, as long as they appear to just have their relationship with shareholders and not with Americans, that we cannot get support for trade in the United States Congress. But if they're partners with us, if they try to prevent this economic damage, if it has to happen because of globalization, they're in there to help to educate these children to get involved in other types of successful enterprises, if they become partners and realize that they have an obligation to this country and not just to the corporate structure, we can work together. Everything that we Democrats are trying to put in a trade program are things that Americans support, and we're having some resistance now from the United States trade representatives. What are we saying? Protect foreign workers, be against child labor, slave labor. Yes, we want to protect the rights of patented medicines, but if it's going to prevent people that have life-threatening diseases from dying, then make certain we have exceptions to that. And also to protect the intellectual property rights of our corporations. Provide for education for employees so that they can become competitive. Get involved in trying to have national health insurance so that when you compete against countries which has nationalized education and nationalized health care, that we're not at a disadvantage. And so what I'm trying to do is to bring Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives together. And guess what? We're almost there, as that story that you referred to. We can make a united front on trade, unions and entrepreneurs working together for a better America.
After all these years of supporting a Republican agenda, do you really think you're going to flip the legions of CEOs over to your side of the ledger on that? That sounds like a big turn that you're describing. And maybe it'll happen, but it's not how the trade groups and business groups have lined up for a long time, Congressman.
I ask these people, what is the difference how much money and profits you can make if at the end of the day you find cities being dilapidated because of a lack of investment in infrastructure? If you find out major jobs because economically it's feasible for them to be created overseas at the loss of jobs in the United States? If you say that we're getting lower price goods, if you say we're getting higher income, high-tech jobs. When last have we seen people picketing the Congress saying, I got my job through international trade or through the NAFTA or CAFTA? And the truth is, our kids can hardly afford to go to school. They can hardly get this high-tech education. And if they do, they can hardly get a job if we're going to go to India instead of using our own kids. We got cities and towns collapsing, and so you make an appeal, every one of these CEOs, and I've dealt with the top 20 in the United States and the chairman. They have to have some love for this country. They can't drive all of the jobs overseas without helping create opportunities for us. Now, yes, it sounds like democratic principles, but more and more people are understanding that these are American principles. We just can't go at each person for themselves. It is not so. The people that never supported Social Security never knew the lives that have been saved by Social Security. And to be able to have workers that don't know one day from the other whether they got to survive because they don't have health insurance, that doesn't make for a strong America. So all of the principles that I knew on Lenox Avenue have now grown so big in this country, including lack of affordable housing, I can say that unless we can have an America that can hope and dream to do better than their parents and a better life for their children, then we've lost what made us so great.
Lenox Avenue.
And we're losing it every day.
Lenox Avenue in Harlem, speaking right there through the new chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Charles Rangel. Let's take a call from Marion, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air with Congressman Rangel.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
I've got two comments. Number one, we should never stop the draft to start with, and because that put a lot of young teenagers out on the street, and they end up in prison. Number two, we should take the ones that are in prison for anything rather than rape or murder and put them into service for 6 years, train them, pay them, treat them like regular soldiers, and if they survive that 6 years, they got a complete pardon.
Have our war fought by criminals, by convicted criminals?
They're not convicted criminals. They made a mistake. Haven't you ever made a mistake before?
Yes, I have, but not one that ended up with me in prison.
Well, I said those, if they're there for rape or for murder, don't allow them. But the ones that are there they got caught with drugs
or something else
minor, that they're serving 6 to 8 years over, take them, draft them first, give them a choice. They go, they serve 6 years, they survive, they got a complete...
Robert, we've got the program. Congressman Rangel, what do you say?
I think it makes some sense. Not necessarily the military has to be an option, but I do think that, we're the only... We got more people in jail than most of the whole world put together. We got over 2 million people in jail. And the question is a balance of being punitive and being productive. And so it seems to me that they're just punishing people and have them languish in jail and producing nothing for society. They should be given options, not necessarily just the military, but if they're willing to do something for their country, to make a contribution to society, and to make some sacrifices, they should be tested maybe 5, 6, 7 months, depending what the objectives. And if they prove that they've learned a lesson, and you don't have to do 10 or 15 years to learn a lesson, and like he said, if you're not a danger, physical danger to society, give a guy a break. I tell you one thing, when I was a kid, they weren't doing a lot of arresting. They just whipped your butt and sent you back home. I've made a lot of mistakes when I was a kid, a lot of mistakes in life. And fortunately, when I got cleared by the FBI to become an assistant U.S. attorney, I was born again. And so, listen, a lot of people make mistakes.
There's Charlie Rangel with a big view. Let's go to Jude in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Jude, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Jude. I'm a 65-year-old woman, mother of three sons, one of which is headed back to Iraq in September for his second time.
Yep. Him and a whole lot of others heading back for second and third tours.
Him and a whole lot of others. Everybody goes back.
Yep.
That's the way it goes. Everybody
yep.
goes back. He's in the National Guard. He's a volunteer. He goes there as a volunteer.
So what do you say to Congressman Rangel?
I say fabulous. Everything he said is fantastic. I totally support him. I want to tell people that there is no war. There is no war there. That's not what we're doing. We are doing security for the big companies. This is about the economy. And that's what I want to say. And I want to say thank you so much, Congressman.
Jude, we got it.
Thank you, your brave mother, to say this. And people don't understand what she does. You know, when a kid comes back home, whether he has a family, the pain that they've suffered in his absence. Many employers don't give the respect and the opportunity when these guys come back, their jobs are filled. You know, the more people in America that understands this, the more they reevaluate the Civil War, the more they reevaluate how important it was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. We may want to accomplish all of these things, but with whose children?
Charles Rangel, our time begins to grow short here. The Democrats in power on the Hill, you describe yourself as part of that, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, in the Clinton years, in the 90s, there was a lot of DLC and more a centrist vision of what the Democrats ought to be. Where do you see the Democrats pushing now? Republicans wanted a permanent majority. They've lost that already. But what about your party? What's it really pushing for?
Stopping the war, I think, is the major thing that we have to accomplish. And finding some way to rebuild the hope in the United States. It's really rough as an American to have foreigners look at you as though they feel sorry for you. A part of what makes us successful is our self-esteem, believing that we're doing the right thing. And we've lost a lot of that. And making America stronger, you know, national security just isn't the military. National security is an educated America, productive America, competitive America. We're going to have to get that strength back in education. We're going to have the American dreams. You know, being poor is bad.
Mm.
But if you lose your dream, if you don't think that you can get out of your circumstances, it's a hell of a lot worse. Democrats have to restore some confidence in politicians and the Congress, and I think we're doing that. And I think that even next year we'll do much better. And just hope that the future will be a lot better than what we're going through now. And in recognizing that for generations, life has always been better for the next generation, and this generation can't say that. Our kids are going to have trillions of dollars, ten trillions of dollars in debt just when they're born. We got to make certain that Social Security is there for them, that health care is there for them, that opportunity is there for them. And I don't think we want to do it as Democrats. I think we want to do it in partnership with Republicans. True, there should always be a difference in the parties, but not enough to be partisan.
Charles Rangel, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee since the Democratic takeback of the Congress in November. His new memoir is "And I Haven't Had a Bad Day Since." Congressman Rangel, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom, for the opportunity.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.